Alrighty, this could be a long one. So let me start with just a little bit of context about what it's like here at the moment, day-to-day life, because I think many people are finding it interesting how all of us are sort of, you know, trying to adapt under the circumstances. So again, we're in a very fortunate part of the world here where, first of all, the weather is awesome. It is presently 29 Celsius. Been aside too long. Celsius today. Well, it's 29 Celsius. Now we're heading for 31 today, which is not too bad given that we're halfway through autumn on the way to winter. So we're tracking pretty well there. And just the nature of the climate here, it's just normally like crystal clear blue skies this time of year. It's sunny. I've been down the beach having a swim this morning. I know, it sounds really obnoxious saying it that way. But the way it is for us at the moment, I've cut out basically all the sort of non-essential travel stuff, including any water sports with things with motors on them. So boat, jet ski, all that sort of stuff is not moving anywhere. But bike riding, good, doing loads of walks, going for lots of swims. The tennis club is open again for one-on-one sessions, either with a partner or with a coach. So I'm going to be hitting that up again next week, which is good news. And it's sort of like at an equilibrium that feels like it's going to be sustainable in a pretty sort of happy, not messing with your life too much way for some time yet. So we'll see how long that has to last. Kids back at school next week. So school from home. Yeah, again, I don't know how long that will last. We'll have to wait and see. I think it's going to be at least many, many, many weeks, and we'll see what happens after that. Anyway, being at home, many things have been happening at home. And in all honesty, like, I've been getting to the end of each day and just going, holy crap, like, where did that day go? And why is there still so much stuff on my backlog that I haven't done yet? And I suspect part of the answer to that is the fact that there are school holidays and the kids are sort of always around. So anyway, be that as it may, one of the things I tweeted this week that people just lost their mind over. In fact, there are three different things I'm going to talk about. In fact, four probably things I'm going to talk about today that were tweets that resulted in a lot of engagement. Now, the first mind-losing one was, we did have a bit of a spider infestation. This isn't me going like all Australia on you. I'll link to the photo of the tweet, but I came downstairs the other night and in the media room where we normally sort of be sitting there watching TV, up on the ceiling, there were like literally hundreds of spiders crawling out of the air vent across the roof. And as some people pointed out, they were huntsman spiders, which are very, very mildly poisonous. Like, we don't worry about them all as humans. Tiny, tiny ones. Yes, I did find the mother. It galloped away under the couch. So God knows where that is now, but I'm sure it's fine. It's just out there eating birds or something like that. Life in Australia. So that was that. That's the only like non-infosec stuff I've got. Everything else is actually relevant now to either infosec or other technology-related things. And the second thing that did actually get a lot of traction on social this week was some commentary around Zoom. Now, my view of Zoom, I have many views on Zoom. It has had this astronomical growth. I mean, look, if you had shares in Zoom right now, you would be a very, very happy camper because they've basically had like 10 years worth of growth compressed into the space of a couple of months. And obviously that has shone a massive spotlight on them. So there's a bunch of people been looking at their privacy policies, a bunch of people been looking at their security. And imagine that you had like 10 years worth of growth of everyone's focus being on you, and then you compress that into this small amount of time. And you wouldn't believe it, but people find some stuff. Found security stuff, found privacy stuff, all the rest of it. So inevitably, along with this massive growth, they've had this focus, and there's been a bunch of stuff that has come out in the press about shortcomings on their behalf. And they are shortcomings. You're not going to sugarcoat some of these. My feeling, though, is that the shortcomings are not any different to the sorts of shortcomings that we'd find with other products if we shone like 10 years worth of spotlight on them in one small period of time. And there has been a lot of hand-waving from people about risks with Zoom. Now, there's a couple of things in particular. One of them, and this one sort of really bugs me, is, well, they all really bug me, but there's a first one that bugs me. One of them is that people get very, very focused on the one side of the scale, which is here's everything that is wrong, and not on the other side of the scale, which is here is what it's actually doing for humanity in a really, really difficult time. It almost just sort of feels like this internet attitude of like, how negative can we be? How much can we beat this particular company with the stick of displeasure? And I'm sort of seeing people say things like, I would never use Zoom. I was like, well, you're never coming to one of my workshops then, are you? Because if I want to run a workshop for NDC, they have been using Zoom. They're going to use WebEx later on, but that's another story. So if you wanted to come to either the Copenhagen ones I did a couple of weeks ago, Scott, or the ones we did on the Aussie time zone before that, it is Zoom. If you don't want to use Zoom, you don't get to come to the workshop. There's all sorts of social things that happen with Zoom. So what are you going to do? Go, look, I'm just not going to talk to my friends because I don't like their privacy policy. And instead, I'm going to get them to use this other company who's probably got an equally bad privacy policy. And we just haven't inspected their security. But, you know, hey, reasons? Like, it just feels ridiculous. And people get so staunchly adamant that you should never use this thing. When I say people, it's obviously a very, very small fraction of people. Because let's face it, a lot of people are using Zoom at the moment. But it's just incommensurately crazy hand-waving. Now, the other thing which has been bugging me around the Zoom narrative, is that inevitably they have copped a whole bunch of credential stuffing attacks. Now, as a quick refresher, credential stuffing attacks are where someone looks at the process of authenticating to a service, so in this case Zoom, and they'd look at it and they go, oh, you got to make an HTTPS request, it's a post request to this path, and you've got to have a field called email address and a field called password, and that is what the HTTP request is constructed of. Now, we're going to start making a gazillion of those, gazillion being thousands, millions, however many it may be, as many as we can get. We'll send them through open proxies. We'll send them through VPNs. We'll send them through botnets. We'll randomize UA strings. We'll do all sorts of things to avoid any sort of pattern that can easily be blocked. We'll hammer them, and then every time a username and a password from another data breach work, bam, we're going to put that on the list of, air quotes, breached Zoom accounts. So there's been a couple of things in the press. I think the first one I saw was something like 20,000 accounts. The second one I've seen is 500,000 accounts. And it was really, really crystal clear in the news stories that these were credential stuffing attacks. So I linked to one here. So this was 3 days ago. The headline is, over 500,000 Zoom accounts sold on hacker forums, the dark web. Now, you know it's scary because they said dark web. Now, this is Bleeping Computer. I would have liked the headline to be a little bit clearer. However, literally the second sentence in this story is, these credentials are gathered through credential stuffing attacks where the threat actors attempt to log into Zoom using accounts leaked in older data breaches. The successful logins are then compiled into lists that are sold to other hackers. They make it really, really clear, like right at the beginning of the story, that this is not someone finding, say, SQL injection vulnerability with Zoom and sucking all the accounts out. And if it was all the accounts, it'd be a lot more than 500,000 at the moment too. This is people reusing passwords. So I've ended up, hours after posting this and having multiple people go, oh, this is why you should never use Zoom because I've already had a data breach. And I've quote tweeted this and I said, people, for fuck's sake, this is not a reason to avoid Zoom. It's a reason to stop using the same bloody password everywhere. That has 717 likes, that particular tweet. And then I've received multiple emails from people saying, when are you going to load the Zoom data breach into Have I Been Pwned? There's not a Zoom data breach. There's about 500,000 people who reuse the same password on Zoom as other places. Now, be that as it may, I have made the argument many times before that organizations do need to be more resilient to credential stuffing attacks. The FTC in the US has also said that being the corporate victim of a credential stuffing attack doesn't mean that they're not going to have a case brought against them. So Zoom does have some accountability in this. I would just prefer to see the narrative being a lot more accurate than what it has been before. Now, apparently this list of 500,000 is being sold on the dark web. I'm air quoting a lot today, aren't I? Being sold on the dark web. If it ever turns up publicly, I'll have to take a look at it and I'll have to decide what to do with it. With Have I Been Pwned? I don't want to have it represented as a Zoom data breach. On the other hand, if it's 500,000 people whose accounts are at risk, I also kind of want them to know. Now, inevitably, Zoom will be forcing them to rotate passwords if they ever get their hands on that list. But we also know that plenty of people don't actually get those notices or they're not aware, and I'd like to be able to let them know. So look, we'll deal with that if it turns up. All right, so stop losing your freaking minds over Zoom. Just enjoy socializing with some people and learning some stuff. Come on. All right, now, oh boy, this one blew up. Should have known it was going to blow up. Coronavirus tracking apps. A bunch of people started asking me my views on a coronavirus tracking app. So let's just take a step back from my personal views and the narrative I'm about to talk about and just define what we mean by this. So various countries around the world, Singapore is a very noteworthy one, have released apps via the government. So Singapore's got one called Trace Together. Released apps via the government, which are official government apps. They obviously run on your smart device and they use Bluetooth to identify when there are other people running the app around you. So let's say you and I both had the app, both running. I've obviously got an iPhone here. Maybe you're running it on your Android. They see each other and they go, oh, I've been around. Let's say you're Mary, you know, like I've been around Mary and we come into contact and we're together in the same proximity for half an hour or something like that. Now, later on, if Mary contracts coronavirus and tests positive, it would be good for me to know that I've just spent a bunch of time with someone who has actually contracted coronavirus. So the value proposition of these apps is that it would be possible to notify me that Mary, well, in fact, let me be clear about this. It wouldn't notify me that Mary had contracted coronavirus because of privacy, we're going to talk about this, but I had been in proximity of someone who has tested positive. And I would then be able to go, oh, I probably need to be a bit more careful. You know, maybe I won't hug the kids until I get tested and I make sure I'm okay. Maybe I'll wear a mask. Maybe I'll take additional precautions. And of course, the goal here is to try and reduce the spread. Now, conversely, if I was tested and I had coronavirus, I would be able to tell the app and the app would then be able to broadcast to people who were in the same proximity as me that perhaps they should go and get tested. Now, this is the sort of, this would be the Wikipedia definition, assuming there is one, of like a COVID-19 tracking app. This raises many, many, many different issues around privacy. And holy shit, some people have lost their minds over this. So one of the reasons I decided to write this thread is someone sent me a short clip from a TV show called The Project. Which is a very well-known TV show here in Australia. It's like a news current affairs sort of show with a bunch of panelists. I've been on the show before talking about InfoSec things. And their host, Waleed Ali, who's a really, really interesting bloke, very, very smart guy. I love watching what he says. But he made some comments which I thought were really out of line and misrepresentative of the risks and the things that we should be considering. And in fact, what he said, I just watched it again now because I've now written an op-ed piece for a media outlet that I'll talk about once it actually goes live if they publish it. But he said there are three words that scare the hell out of me: government tracking device. So one of the headlines that's been picked up. And the other thing he said is he effectively cast dispersions on the integrity of the app because Singapore has a very autocratic government. So they have effectively absolute power. Now, I spent years living in Singapore. I got a pretty good idea of what he means by that. And yeah, like the government is all controlling in Singapore. However, does that devalue the app? Does that produce an unnatural risk? I mean, we've literally got our Australian Signals Directorate here, which is part of our Department of Defence, reviewing this app for privacy concerns at the moment, going through it, one would hope, line by line, checking out the code. So I do feel that that is a very, very hyperbolic statement to make, and it makes people very concerned about running it. I want to go through this thread because I sat here for probably half an hour, wrote up all the tweets, and I was thinking, please don't let my PC crash or anything like this because I got this perfect tweet thread going, and I posted it. I want to sort of read through it now and explain exactly what I meant by this because there's been a lot of engagement on this. It's been a lot of likes, a lot of retweets, but there's also been some people who've been very angry at me. Now, I understand this is Twitter. This is what a lot of people do. They just want to be angry. I've tweeted about my car before. I love my car. People get angry because they don't love my car. Anyway, so, okay, folks, let's talk about the coronavirus tracking app as news of Australia adopting Singapore's Trace Together gains momentum. I'd willingly run it, and I want to explain why, because there's also some very valid concerns. Let's begin. Firstly, we all know there is an absolutely unprecedented time. This is an absolutely unprecedented time that's resulted in all sorts of unprecedented measures. When people are losing their livelihoods and in some cases losing their lives, the ROI of privacy changes. We need to look at it differently today. Now, this is very true. You cannot disagree that this is an absolutely unprecedented time. And as a result, we do have to do some things today as a society which we wouldn't have done yesterday. I've just talked about the fact I can't go on my boat and my jet ski. And yes, I know that's a very first world problem. You don't need to point that out. I also can't go and visit my parents at the moment. Well, I can, but I choose not to. I'm not spending time with my family. My kids aren't playing with their friends. I can't even go and sit at a cafe and have a coffee. I have to get it on a tray and take it away. Like, we are all making sacrifices in a very unprecedented time. It's not open for debate. You can't argue the point. We are. That's how it is. The discussion is whether this should be one of the things that fits into that change of normal behavior in this unprecedented time. I'm willing to take risks with my privacy in ways that I wouldn't have only 2 months ago. I'll happily make that trade-off if I can see it's going to be in the best interest of society, just as I'm happy making other sacrifices today. So let's talk about that for a moment. This is really the narrative that I just had when I went off the script here. I'm happy to make sacrifices if I feel they're in the best interest. And inevitably you are too. I can't imagine there's anyone watching this that hasn't made changes to their life, not just for their own well-being, but for that of society and the community around them. We all have beacons in our pockets that travel with us everywhere. They have the capability to know where we go, when we go there, and who we interact with. From the perspective of establishing the possible spread of the virus, this is amazing technology, and we already have it. We have GPS, Bluetooth, and cellular, and the fact that we could so easily just install one little piece of software in a matter of seconds that would make this all work together in humanity's best interest is pretty cool. Now, again, putting aside your sort of privacy views and everything for a moment, you can't argue with that bit either. This is cool. It is amazing that I can chuck this thing in my pocket and I can walk around the streets and it could communicate with other people. The question is, how can we do that in a way that is actually of net value and doesn't make erosions to fundamental principles around things like privacy? But don't lose the fact for a moment that this is super, super, super cool technology. We have it already. It's in our pockets. We couldn't have had this discussion even 10 years ago. We didn't have the ubiquity of the devices that we have today. So this is amazing stuff. Just for a moment, consider how different the current situation would be if we all had the ability to immediately establish if we'd been in the proximity of someone who has since tested positive. How many would have tested earlier, self-isolated, worn a mask, lived? And this is really the point. And yeah, I don't know anyone directly who's died of this yet. I suspect many of you watching this do. I know a bunch of people who've contracted it and they've been scared as hell. But the discussion here, when you're sort of talking about there's a privacy risk here, there's an I might die risk here, this is a very different discussion to a few months ago when there's a privacy risk here, but on the other side of the scale, there's nothing of much significance. Dying is significant, whether it's you or your partner or your parents. You know, that's honestly, like, this is the biggest risk for me. My parents, they're fit and healthy, but they're in their early 70s. They're in the demographic. But of course, there are concerns, and chief among them is privacy. There's a bunch of different ways this can be tackled, and many of the controls I've seen mentioned go a long way to addressing it. For example, only recording interactions with other people of 15 minutes or more. So this is one of the things that's been raised. How long is long enough to be an interaction that is significant enough to justify recording? Now, one of the things we've got to keep in mind is that none of this is ever going to be perfect. It's not going to be perfect because this is opt-in. You're never going to get everyone running it, and it should damn well be opt-in as well. It's also not going to be perfect because some people won't get tested, or they'll get tested later. Like, there's all these sorts of things that make it not perfect. One of the things that makes it not perfect is you can have a moment of contact with someone, but they sneeze on you, and then you could be sitting across the table from someone for an hour, but you don't contract it to someone who's positive. So I think the idea of there being a threshold where your interaction has been sustained enough to raise your risk to a certain level makes sense. Because otherwise, someone's out there, I was walking down the beach today. How many different Bluetooth beacons would I have connected to? But it's literally two people walking past each other several meters away. I don't think that that is going to justify recording that data, because by recording that data, now there is an interaction which, let's say everything goes completely wrong, could be lost and my privacy eroded. So The whole idea of there being a minimum threshold to even collect the data is important because this also speaks to the principle of data minimization. Let us collect just what we need in order to do the job. Now, maybe 15 minutes is the right number. I don't know, maybe it should have been 14 minutes or 15 and a half minutes. Who knows? The point is, I like the principle of there being a threshold. And smarter people than me when it comes to health and how things can transmit will figure out what that is. Anonymization is obviously key here. You wouldn't need to know who you're in contact with that tested positive, only that it happened and when it was. That, of course, could still be a very narrow scope of people, and frankly, the likelihood of true anonymity is low. So we often hear this term pseudo-anonymity. So anonymity, but not like complete anonymity. And we've seen all sorts of things in the past where anonymized studies, for example, have been released. And then researchers are going, not really quite so anonymous because I can start to reverse engineer this stuff. So I'm really cautious that when we see discussion about anonymity, it is not necessarily anonymity in the sense of we simply cannot figure out who it was. And it would surprise me greatly if, let's say, all the data that's being collected on devices as part of this program got released. It would surprise me greatly if someone couldn't reverse engineer that and start to get really good ideas of who it was that you actually came into contact with. So keep that in mind. This is not like complete anonymity, but let's talk about some of the other mitigating controls. Now, here's one of these controls. Decentralizing the data and retaining it only on the device is another logical control. Of course, there needs to be some exchange of data, either to submit your own positive status or be notified of your exposure, but it need not be masses of info on a centralized system. This is absolutely key. I think it's fair to say that I have a much better sense of data breaches than most people. Like, this is my livelihood. I see data breaches left, right, and center every single day. When there is a single repository of data, there is a much, much, much greater risk to privacy than if there were tiny repositories of data on each of our individual phones. This fundamentally changes the risk proposition. I would feel much better as an individual if I knew my data only sat here, and then the only time it goes up there into the cloud, which of course is other people's computers, is if I test positive, or if it needs to pull back the fact that there's been an interaction with someone else who's tested positive. This is a massive win for privacy. It's a little bit like, people get very upset about things like biometrics. Again, it's the internet, they get upset. Biometrics, Face ID on the iPhone. Well, all of that data sits inside the secure enclave just on my device. It doesn't sit there in like a database on Apple's server called Faces. This is just not how it works. Think also about the Think also about the data minimization opportunities. You could capture location via GPS, but is it necessary if you can already track proximity to people via Bluetooth? Do you care where you were or just that you spent time with someone who was infected? So this is important too. Now, again, someone who works in the medical profession may tell me that there is actually value in knowing physical location, but one would imagine that just being in proximity with someone is sufficient. And think about sort of incubation periods, lead time, testing, get results back. I would imagine that you're normally going to be looking at a mean, let's say there's a mean of like 1 week after someone is infected, before they actually have the test, it's positive, they submit it to the app, you get notified. So now it's like, okay, so where was I roughly a week ago? You don't have to know exactly when it was. You only need to know a date range because that'll give you an idea of how long your own sort of incubation period is as well. So if it said, look, Troy, 8 days ago, you're in contact with someone who had it. I'll be like, okay, well, mind you, in the current climate, I'm not going a lot of places. So that does kind of narrow it down in terms of where I was 8 days ago. But was I walking along the beach? Was I in the supermarket? Was I at the tennis club? Like, what was it? And again, it doesn't matter so much. It just matters that I was in contact with someone. Okay, what's next here? Then there's retention periods. There's only a finite usefulness of the data in managing the pandemic. And the old adage of you cannot lose what you do not have makes a lot of sense here. Retain it for the shortest possible period. So I've seen discussions around sort of a 3-week period. You don't need the data for any more than 3 weeks. And I guess if we, let's sort of extrapolate that out further. Would it really be much use for me to know that 6 weeks ago I was in contact with someone who's just tested positive? Because remember, we've sort of got this 14-day period we keep hearing about. Look, if you're okay after 14 days, you're fine. So I don't know that you get much value from that. I imagine there could be some cases, but it might be one of these sort of half-life scenarios where, you know, like 3 weeks after that, the value of it just really, really drops off the cliff. So on the balance of scales here, let's just not have the data, because we get a lot of privacy gain by not retaining this data, and we lose very little in terms of the value that it could have posed if we kept it. That's a sensible decision. Also, open source the whole stack. Let privacy folks, security folks, and software folks go through the whole thing from top to bottom. One of the single biggest concerns is government tracking beyond intended purposes, so make the whole thing as transparent as possible. Now this, just eyeballing the tweets here, has the most likes out of all the tweets I can presently see on the screen. And that's because it makes sense. So if we had the ability to see exactly how these things work, then that is fantastic. Now, incidentally, people have pointed me to a GitHub repository for Trace Together. I'm air quoting this because it is a reference implementation. As far as I know, it's not the actual product that Singaporeans have built. So by open sourcing, we get visibility into how the software product works. Now, many people have since said, aha, but how can you be confident that the open sourced version is the same as what's running on your phone? Now, there's sort of a few different things here. So number one is that software products installed to phones do get decompiled. We see this the entire time. They get downloaded, they get reverse engineered, people pick them apart and figure out how they work. It would be a massively high risk proposition, let's say for the Aussie government, to say, you know what we're going to do? We're going to publish something in a public source control repository, and then we're going to change it so that people don't know, and then we're going to push it out to the phones, and she'll be right, mate, no one will ever know. That would be massively high risk, because not only would you need a whole bunch of people within government to actually be in on this together, and yes, I'm conscious that that has happened at times in the past, although these are exceptional times, but as soon as someone does join those dots and work that out, that's it. Like, the whole thing is dead. Trust absolutely gone, and probably the government boot of our office as well. So I think the likelihood of that happening is very, very low, because it would be so easy to pick up if it happened, because it's not just decompiling packages either. There's, of course, the ability to look at network traffic. So there are lots of different techniques that we would have to look at both the product that is installed and then the way it communicates over the wire, and reconcile that with the alleged product which is being run, i.e. the open sourced version of it. It's not to say it's impossible. We have seen some funky stuff in the past. I'm just saying it's very unlikely, and it would be very, very high risk on behalf of the government. And then the question is also, how necessary is it? Because the conspiracy theorists will say, well, because this will be a way of the government actually managing to track you, because they want to, let's say, implement Australia's assistance and access bill, which is a little bit like our snooper's charter for people in the UK. You know, they could do it through this app. So boy, oh boy, that is a high stakes proposition there. In terms of how this would roll out, obviously it'd be opt-in, and equally, there must be the ability to opt out. For example, once the value of it is sufficiently low. Fingers crossed that time comes. The Gov should also clearly sunset it at some time. We just don't know when yet. And this is one of the problems, because people are sort of saying, well, if the government rolls this out, they should tell people when they're going to shut it down. It's like, all right, when's coronavirus going to be over again? Like, let me just check my calendars. We don't know this yet. And part of the answer is sort of dependent on how well the community controls the whole thing. And part of that is by running apps like this, which help us get the thing under control, ironically enough. Now, having said all that, if it is an app that you install on your phone and you can uninstall from your phone, then that is true opt-in and opt-out. And it's something that you can do on demand whenever you want to as well. This is not like some sort of pro, let's say the Australian e-health system, where it's like, look, your health records are going to be online and you need to submit forms, and it goes off into a system somewhere and it's in a queue and it hopefully gets No, this is like, it is on your phone. You don't want to be part of it? Uninstall it. So the opt-out there is much more explicit than with other programs. And while I'm here, let's not sensationalize the risk for some of the ridiculous hyperbole I've seen in the media. For example, saying that the Singaporean software product is unsafe because of their autocratic government is just ridiculous. And again, open source it. So it goes back to the Waleed Ali comment before. Let's also stop using terms such as giving up our privacy, as though privacy is some absolute position. This is about one small part of our overall privacy posture. Nobody can read your email or see you via your webcam if you install this. And I really, really want to ram this point home because it bugs the hell out of me, where you see headlines which imply, oh, you've got privacy now. If you install this, you won't have privacy. Bullshit. Like, that is such a simplistic argument, it's ridiculous. So, really good example of this. In fact, I put it in the op-ed piece I wrote just before, and a few people pointed me to this. There was a headline only last week. Google tracked his bike ride past a burglarized home. That made him a suspect. And the byline here is, I was using an app to see how many miles I rode my bike, and now it was putting me at the scene of the crime. So this bloke in the US got an email. In fact, this was Runkeeper. How about that? So this bloke, Zachary McCoy, was riding his bike. He went past a house which was obviously being robbed at the time he rode past. Google managed to get his data. Lawyers sent him a letter, said, look, we're basically handing your data over to the authorities because he's running a tracking app. And the irony of all of this privacy discussion is between the number of apps we run and the huge amount of data they collect, and the fact that you've got a freaking cellular device in your pocket which does connect to cellular towers and the telcos know when and they know where, there's a huge amount of tracking happening already. So if you want to apply the Boolean privacy argument, you know, yes, you have it all or no, you have none of it, well, then you're really on the latter. You have none of it because you're already giving it up by having a freaking smartphone in your pocket in the first place. I felt better. So the point about this absolute state of privacy is just fundamentally wrong. So we need to look at privacy as something much more nuanced. In the case of things like the coronavirus tracking app, okay, what could happen? It might know who I had interactions with for a short period of time if someone could get it and de-anonymize it. Okay, that is a risk. They're not going to see me nude via my webcam. That's a bit of privacy I still have, right? This is a different thing. They're also not going to see my emails. They're not going to see the chats I have. They're not going to see all these other things. I still have all of those things in private. They're confidential. There is this other bit, which is the interactions, which is the bit that I'm putting at risk. And then the question you've got to ask yourself is it worth the trade-off? That one little bit, is it worth the trade-off to possibly not die or have other people die as a result of me infecting them? And that is really the heart of the question here. Suggesting the Gov is incapable of running this safely because of incidents such as the Australian 2016 census getting DDoSed is also just ridiculous. That IBM wasn't able to keep the census stable in no way indicates that this project is somehow incapable of being run well. Now, I keep hearing this bullshit argument the whole time. And I actually had a good comeback, which of course I never got a response on from someone. But a bunch of people said, this government is incapable of running projects well. Think about the census. You know, so in 2016, so every 4 years Australia runs a census. And in 2016, basically the census got massively overwhelmed. It seemed to be, I think there was malicious DDoS in there as well, but a lot of it seemed to be organic DDoS, where it's like, hey, everyone needs to go and use this system on the same night. And guess what? There's a lot of people trying to use it. And now it's running slow and it won't work. Now, that was a major cock up that the government has to take accountability for. They sort of threw IBM under the bus. I think the last I heard about it was the government was trying to take them to the cleaners for the tune of about $30 million. That was a mess. And there have been other things that have been a mess as well. Like, let's be clear about it. And when someone sort of raised this with me, I said to them, which of the government projects do you think have run well? And then there were crickets. Because the thing with governments, and as I've spent more and more time with them, I've sort of learned this more and more. I just remember I've got to talk about a government thing today. I'll put that under there. They do have a lot of systems, and a lot of them do run very well. And the problem is that it only makes the headlines when they go wrong. It's a little bit like all of the people that I've engaged with in government around the world have absolutely, without exception, always been lovely, fantastic people. People who want to go and have a beer with, people who are super smart, super dedicated. They're working for a fraction of what they would in private enterprise. They want to make the world a better place. They're lovely. And then I'll go to a conference or someone and someone will say, well, hey, look, isn't the government just trying to screw you because I saw the stuff about Snowden? And it's like, well, that is going to make headlines. But when this bloke in Canberra, who's doing an absolutely sensational job of what he does, has done something that's fantastic at actually tracking some of the nasty stuff we want to stop, you don't see that in the headlines. Like, that doesn't make the front page of the news. Last bit. So, in summary, this has the potential to be high value and low risk. We should all want this to work in a way that's privacy centric, and just as with social distancing, view it as something we do in the short term, then put it behind us for the betterment of our long term. And honestly, like, this is the absolute heart of it. Let's do this thing in the most privacy centric way possible. Let's all try and run this thing because it works much better the more people you have using it, and make sure that it's only a short-term thing. And we do this as part of making sure it's a short-term thing, just in the same way as we all try and stay at home and not go out and do many of the things that we would like to do. We do it in the short term for the betterment of our long term. In the op-ed piece I wrote, I wrapped it up with a comment that someone left to this thread. And the guy said, I love my privacy, but I love my mother even more. And again, like, that's a very... I understand the sentiment of that. It does imply that privacy is kind of binary, which obviously I don't agree with. But the sentiment is very, very true. Like, let's make a little bit of a sacrifice here, a little bit of a risk, in order to make something that's much more important to us sustainable. So that's that. I have a feeling I'm going to be talking more about that in the future. But for now, I know I've gone on a bit there, but that is something I'm super passionate about, because I want us to get through this thing, and we have the technology available to do it, and we should be focusing on how we do it in a responsible way. All right, let's put that to bed, talk about something more fun. Ubiquity. I have had a very fun Easter long weekend building up all of my Ubiquity things. Now, when I did the weekly update last week, I did an unboxing of the entire server cabinet. I have been very, very busy since that time. Now, I have got all of this in one massive tweet thread. Every thread has photos or screen caps as well. I'm not going to go through them all because I just spent a long time talking about coronavirus tracking app. But long and short of it is everything has gone into the cabinet. I'm just going to flick through and sort of summarize it here. It's all gone into the cabinet. I decided to put the patch panel up the top. In fact, almost up the top. I took it down one RU just to leave a little bit of space so I could get my finger under and turn on the fan and things. Plus, it's an 18 RU cabinet. I do not need all of the RUs that are in there. So that's right at the top. I've ended up putting the 24-port switch just beneath that, and then the Unified Dream Machine, henceforth known as UDM, just below that, which is fine. And then I've got a brush panel under it. And if you've never seen a brush panel, it's a standard 1RU height. And then within that brush panel, there's like literally brushes that you'd have almost like a hairbrush so that you can poke cables through, but it still sort of keeps the whole thing pretty much closed so that air doesn't go flying backwards and forwards through there. Simply so that when you turn the fan on and it sucks air up, it's meant to sort of suck it up from the bottom, and you've got the warm side behind all the panel stuff, and you've got the cool side, which is the outside facing the glass of the rack. I did put a second PSU in there, so there are actually a total of 12 ports, power ports, ports, points now at the back of the rack. So that's fine. I started drinking whiskey partway through. That's another story. Got it all up into place, which was good. I got a whole bunch, way more than I needed, of very thin Cat6 patch cables. And these thin cables are super awesome. They're probably about half the diameter. I'm just looking at my normal Cat6 cables on my switch over there. So probably about half the diameter. And by getting a heap of them, I got a bunch of 15-centimeter ones, 6 inches for that one part of the world that hasn't yet moved on. And I've got a whole bunch of really short ones, as well as various ones of different lengths, so that I could patch very easily from patch board through to the switch, but also have some longer ones so that I could run from the UDM back through the brush panel down to devices that end up sitting on shelves, so things like the modem, for example. It has a 6 terabyte Western Digital Red drive in it. Now, I've not yet gotten to the point of needing this because this is going to store the video from the cameras. And I haven't done the camera thing yet, so I'm going to talk about that later on. That'll be next week. Basically, just turn the living room into a building site. And I had to make a decision really early on. Am I going to try and migrate from my existing setup to the new setup? And you can actually sort of back up your config and then restore it. Or am I going to go clean start? And I asked the Twitters about this, and a lot of people were like, I had problems doing this. And then a few people were like, nah, it was fine. And then I was sort of like, what am I actually backing up? Okay, my network configuration. So things like what the SSIDs are, what the passwords are. Well, that's easy to set up. The biggest thing I could come up with, which was going to be a bit of a pain in the ass, was a list of all the client devices, because I give all my clients like nice names. So, you know, I connect, say, my PC here, and it's whatever name the PC has that it broadcasts when it connects to the access point, and then I rename it. So it's called Troy's PC. And then I choose, in the fingerprint section of the Ubiquiti setup, I choose a nice icon to represent the PC. And I kind of didn't want to lose all that, but I also knew that it wasn't a hard thing to reproduce. So anyway, I did actually back up my old config, and then I just went, nah, don't worry about it. Now, the new UDM Pro, as well as the Gen 2 24-port switch, both have LCD panels on the left of the screen, and they're about postage stamp size, and they are super cool because you can just sort of flick through them. You can get different configs and things up. You can put graphs on them that show throughput. They look really, really sweet. Have a look at the tweet thread if you haven't seen it before. Just went through, basically did the normal setup, almost flawless. It couldn't see the internet. I had a coffee, I came back, it could see the internet, so that wasn't too major. I started then basically stealing access points from my old network. So what would happen is I'd unplug an access point from my old network, and Ubiquiti would send an alert to my watch and go, hey, you've just had an access port disconnected. I say, yeah, yeah, don't worry about that. And then I'd plug it into the new network. So I was literally just patching from the old switch into the new switch. And then I would just adopt it into the new network. And you have to put in the credentials from the old network, and then that's fine. So I could just easily start rolling access points over. And I just did that bit by bit by bit. Gave them all nice names. What else happened in here? This was one of my problems. My Synology NAS and also my Raspberry Pi, which I use for the Pi hole, both had static IP addresses on them. Now, my old network was on 192.168.1 subnet. This one was on .0 subnet. So the devices had .1 subnet hard-coded into their IP address. They could not then be seen by devices on the .0 subnet. So eventually I ended up going, oh, like, what's the easiest way to do this? Literally just put a static IP on my laptop on the same subnet, obviously just a different IP address, plug straight into the device, change the IP address, plugged it back into the switch, good job. The only problem I had, and this is sort of the one thing through this entire thread which is painful, was the Raspberry Pi. So you can't update the IP address via the web UI. You've got to SSH into the device and do the setup again. When you do the setup again, the changes I made didn't stick. So I had to go through and actually edit config files on the Raspberry Pi itself, which was not pleasant, and it was just a bit of mucking around, and I blew 2 hours just trying to get the Pi hole working again. But once it's working, absolutely amazing. In fact, I wonder what my stats look like now, because the beautiful thing about the Pi hole is it just blocks so much crap from the network in terms of trackers and ads without taking the risk of running ad blockers on your browser. That's another story. Tweet me separately if you're wondering what that means. So at the moment, I'm seeing in the last 24 hours, I've had 43,000 DNS queries. 29.7% of them have been black-holed. Now that is substantial. There's a real big spike just after 7 a.m. this morning as well. I wonder what that was. Anyway, so Pi hole's working well. Now, when I put the whole thing into the cupboard, and just before you lose your minds, I'm not running like an entire rack inside a very tight cupboard. It's a cupboard which is probably about half the size of this room. It's massive, and it sits under stairs, and it has all the wine and whiskey and stuff like that in there as well. I put all that into the cupboard. I put a Philips Hue strip light in there as well, so I could do LED, you know, funky blue colors, and it looks absolutely amazing. I keep going back into the cupboard just to look at this setup because it is so freaking awesome. So that's really cool. I've used the AR feature that Ubiquiti has. So you can use the phone with the Ubiquiti app. You can put a QR code up on the little LCD panels on the devices, scan the QR code, and then as you move your phone over the ports on the switch and on the UDM as well, it overlays which devices are actually connected to it. How cool is that? That is amazingly cool. So I've got a video in here of what that looks like. What else? That was all my Raspberry Pi problems. Did all that, basically all tracking along well. Now, Just last night, I enabled the threat management feature. So I had not used that on my previous Unify Security Gateway because it was just the standard version, which would then limit throughput to 100 megabit from memory. Now, at the time, I could get just more than 100 megabit on my internet connection. I can only get 60 megabit these days. But regardless, UDM Pro will support up to gigabit, so I was happy enabling that. And at the moment, it's just doing detection. It's not doing any prevention. So it's seeing things like if I fire up Tor, it likes to record that in the event log. It's like, hey, you know, someone's running Tor on this network, which is interesting. Now, there's some other bits I'm going to turn on a little bit later on as well. So I'm going to turn on things like device inspection. So the network can actually go and look at devices on the network, and it can then look at what ports and things like that are open too. So I'm really interested to see what that looks like. So I'm going to turn that on later on and just keep adding to that thread. Now, I don't know if this thread will ever actually have an end, but people are watching it with fascination. So I hope you're enjoying watching my home network build. And I am seeing a lot of people say, yeah, now I'm going to go out and buy Ubiquiti gear as well. And it's look, this is not meant, I don't get anything, just to be clear. If you do go out and buy Ubiquiti gear, I've been public about what they've given me, which is basically the UDM Pro and the Switch. And the cameras, which I'm yet to get to. But I don't get commissions or anything like that. So if you go and get this stuff, get it because you want to, because you think it's cool. I'm not going to get anything as a result of it. So that's where we are with Ubiquiti. Now, hopefully, maybe over the weekend, I'll try and do the camera thing as well. My problem is that all the cameras are wired and I do not have any positions where I actually want to put the cameras where I have Ethernet ports. But I do have a different idea on this. Stay tuned for that. All right, last thing. This has been going a while. Icelandic government, the one blog post I pushed out just last night, welcoming the Icelandic government to Have I Been Pwned. So Iceland's National Computer Security Incident Response Team, which is CERT-IS, is now the 10th government to come on to Have I Been Pwned, which makes me enormously happy. The USA was the last one a few weeks ago. There are others in the wings, which I hope will join over the period of 2020. But super cool to have Iceland on there as well. In fact, I'm getting quite a good little Nordic collection there between Norway, Denmark, and Iceland. So Sweden and Finland, where are you guys? Let's let's jump on board. All right, last thing, sponsorship-wise. Security FWD, a brand new YouTube show from Varonis. So Varonis has been a long-term sponsor and someone that I've done much, much work with over many years. Someone I've actually gone and done in-person events with. Remember when we used to do in-person events? Watch episode one, How Far Can Wi-Fi Travel? So Varonis is back up there on the sponsorship slot. So thank you very much to those guys for their continued support. And of course, I have been blogging a lot more lately as well. So I think the value for sponsors has actually gone up quite a lot. So good on them for their support this week. You will definitely see more of them in the future as well. So thank you for watching this far. I know it has been a long one. I particularly spent a lot of time on that COVID-19 tracking app stuff. I think we're going to be talking a lot more about that in the future. And until then, I hope everyone is making the most of wherever they are finding themselves isolated at the moment. See you next week.